Enjoy this cool and short listicle provided by Dr. Arthur Vosloo from his book, Magic and Mysticism, based on philosopher Hans Jonas's existentialist depiction of Gnosticism. Here it is. 1. A hostile cosmos, Gnostic antipathy to nature. 2. A demiurge, or ignorant creator responsible for botched creation and hostile to human spiritual awakening. 3. Dualism, opposition between the realm of light and the realm of matter. 4. An elaborate mythology. 5. Myths concerning Sophia, wisdom, and her fall and restoration. 6. Belief in a hidden god, not the demiurge. 7. Difficulty of spiritual progress due to the archons or other hostile powers in the cosmos. Ignorance of the inherent fallen human condition. 8. Existence of the Ogdoad, or 8 spheres, including 7 planetary spheres, and possibility of their transcendence. 9. The necessity of Gnosis, or direct spiritual knowledge from the realm of light. 10. A revealer or redeemer figure to show the way to the realm of light.
Valentinus believed the world we live in was created by a cruel god, and slightly stupid. A god that will send you plagues, or require sacrifices, or destroy Babylon.
He wasn't wrong about that. The bastard had a mean temper.
Humans can escape this world, and return to the real one. The kingdom. And for that, you needed to achieve the Gnosis, which could be described as true knowledge.
Welcome, everybody, to AM Byte. I hope you enjoyed that short clip on understanding Gnosticism from the great Hans Jonas. And yes, if you're wondering about that last clip, it's from the Netflix series Feria, which relies heavily on Gnostic themes, although it sort of changes things around. In other words, it's a sort of a small town Lovecraft monster thing, and they decide they're going to give the Lovecraft monster's Gnostic name. So, but it's an interesting show. But welcome again, everybody. So good to see you. My name is Miguel Connor, your Pompidus of Gnosis. Welcome to these Gnostic times, this Philip K. Dick world, and this Age of Hermes. And today I'm very excited because we will be geeking out to early Christian times and Gnosticisms. I always love doing this, and I love promoting a book that I really enjoyed very much. And that book here is A Gospel of the Hebrews by James Brattingham. He has been a past guest to share some of his other works. He's a retired physician and has become an excellent researcher and translator of these ancient texts. Again, he graced the Virtual Alexandria discussing texts like the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Thomas, the Secret Book of John, and so forth. And the world is a better place, and Gnostic studies is certainly been advanced. So, James, thank you very much for coming on the show and doing a live show this time.
Thank you, Miguel.
And how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Life is good. I'm 72 years old, which I can't believe, but my family is good, and we live in California near Malibu. And so I'm looking forward to speaking about the text today.
Good deal. Yeah, because it's fascinating. And again, for the audience, James takes us on an amazing tour in the first part of his book, gives us an excellent summary of Gnosticism, some of the best expositions I've had. For example, as I told him, if you're interested in understanding someone like Basilides, the Gnostic sage in the second century, he gives you a short but concise summary that really hits on all the right notes. And he gives us the latest in Gnostic studies as well as New Testament research that's going on out there. And with us today, it's always a pleasure to have Graham Pong with us. How are you doing, Graham?
Oh, very good. Looking forward to finding out all about the Ebionites, and it's like just where they had their cave relative to the Qumran caves. It seems like there were a bunch of sects all having their own caves out in the desert back in then.
They all met at the local Starbucks and exchanged ideas. And I was going to say too that for those of you wondering, Graham has done a great job being the wingman. Vance, I talked to him briefly. He will be rejoining us at the end of the month from his long sabbatical and walkabout and vacation. So Vance will be coming back just in case you wanted to know. Other than that, not much housekeeping. Great shows next week and coming up. I'm just finishing reading Steven Snyder's book on Stanley Kubrick, and it's completely amazing. We will have a Gnostic priestess next week who will be telling us some great insights on how Gnosticism manifests today in the desert of the real. For those of you also wondering, don't forget I do have voiceover services if you ever need if you ever need some good voiceover work, whether it's your book, podcast intro, film, whatever you want to do, I am there for my services whenever you need it. Don't forget, too, that we also are streaming on Rumble and Rockfin. I know some of you, for ethical reasons, don't like to give money or attention to the big corporations out there. So if you want to catch this show on a more niche platform, you can go there. There are other places, but just let me know. And if we have comments from the audience, again, as always, please super chat them so Graham or myself can separate them. And then we can ask James, we can send these questions to James. So that's about it. James, do you want to get started, or should I pull up the slides, or do you have anything to say?
Well, why don't I pull up a slide and go ahead and get into it? What do you think?
All right, let's do it. Let's go. Oh, that's the wrong slide. Let's get our hands dirty at the stage. All right, there you go. A Gospel of the Hebrews.
Yes, I chose to call it A Gospel of the Hebrews because I don't want to imply that it is the Gospel of the Hebrews. The way I got interested in this textbook, which is mostly the Gospel of Matthew, was as I read about Thomas in India. I also found out that there's a tradition that Bartholomew also went to India about 55 AD or Common Era, and he preached to the same Indians that Thomas did. Then in 190 AD or Common Era, Pantaenus, who was one of the founders of the catechetical school of Alexandria, was sent back to where Bartholomew had preached to the Indians, and he went there. And this was in 190 Common Era. And he was a Stoic philosopher, a highly educated man, a converted Jew who also knew Hebrew and could speak Hebrew, write Hebrew. And so when he was there talking to the Indians, the Nasranis, as they would be called later on, he saw a Hebrew Gospel of Matthew. This is different from my book, but he saw a Hebrew Gospel of Matthew there. And so when he came back to the Alexandria, he brought the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew and didn't just keep it at home. He put it at the school. So it was available to everybody who was there at the school. So I think there's a possibility that we have some Gnostic verses in the Gospel of Hebrews, it may even go back to Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus Christ. And the reason I think this is possible is because Stephen Shoemaker has looked into the research on oral memorization and both oral and literate cultures. And the research done by psychologists on can a person memorize something, hearing it a couple of times, maybe even three times, and memorize it word for word, or keep it anywhere close to a word for word memorization, is he has found that that is not possible. By in most cases, 3 weeks to a month and a half, they've lost almost everything, and the only thing they have left is the gist of some statement or a few statements. However, this changes in literate cultures. So Israel was a literate culture at the turn of the century and during Jesus' life and death. And so if things are written down and a person can go back to the material to memorize it, spend a week, go back and look at the material and memorize it, they can learn everything. And so I believe, and many people do and some don't, that Jesus' family was akin to lower middle class in terms of their society. They were not, I don't think they were terribly poor. This is my personal belief. And so it was very common at that time to send their sons to a yeshiva. And at going to the yeshiva, it was also very common for them to begin the students, the young students, as I believe Jesus was, to do something like memorize the entire Tanakh or Old Testament. So I believe Jesus actually memorized the entire Old Testament or Tanakh, as the Jews call it. And so I think it's possible because we have many different texts, the Gospel of Thomas and so forth, that have some of the same sayings. And so Jesus might have said some of these things, and Matthew, one of his apostles, wrote them down, and that people could go back and read them over and over until they had many of those verses really memorized. As we know regarding science, that it can be done. So in the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, we have a number of Gnostic verses. So we have the verse, "The one who seeks should not cease until he finds, and in finding he shall marvel, and having marveled he shall reign, and having reigned he shall rest." Now, this was written down by Clement of Alexandria, who was at the catechetical school in Egypt. And Dores, when he first looked at, there was also a little piece of this text found in Greek at Oxyrhynchus. Is that right? Yeah. I think it's Oxyrhynchus.
Yeah, I think that's it.
It was a garbage dump, I understand. And right, they pulled out of it. And what's that?
Yeah, you're right.
And they pulled out just before the turn of the 20th century a piece that had the Gospel of Thomas too. And it said, from the Greek, Jesus says, "Let him who seeks cease not to seek until he finds. When he finds, he will wonder. And when he wonders, he will reign. And reigning, he will have rest." Now, Miguel can cue me in on this, but I believe rest was a term by many Gnostics that meant they had achieved gnosis and salvation.
Or an intense state of meditation, sort of Zen.
Okay. So I believe there was a Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, and that over the centuries it was changed with interpolations and deletions into the Gospel of the Hebrews. In fact, there were apparently a variety of texts that eventually all ended up being called a Gospel of the Hebrews. Now, this started when a church father, Papias, who had sat as a Talmid or student of the Apostle John, who had sat at his feet, was told that Matthew had written out in Hebrew, Logia of the Lord, or sayings of the Lord, and of Jesus, of course. So some think that this was even the beginning of what we call Q. And so this has been hotly debated. There are many people that say there was no Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, that somebody just translated it from Greek into Hebrew, and they give reasons. And other people, a less number of scholars, strongly believe that a Hebrew Gospel of Matthew actually existed. And so it all started with this church father, Papias, who wrote an enormous number of books. We've lost them all. They're all gone, completely gone. So today they talk about, some people talk about there being two books, the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, and then its transliteration and change into the Gospel of the Hebrews. And so maybe the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, without being changed or interpolated from what Matthew first wrote, was saved here and there, because as we'll see in a slide later on, possibly, it was looked at in the 8th century, in the 9th century, in Byzantium and in Merv, which I believe is in what we consider to be Iran today. And they looked at a Hebrew Gospel of Matthew and counted up the lines and came to the decision that in a Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, there was no genealogy and there was no nativity. So, again, I believe that a Hebrew Gospel of Matthew existed. And a Gospel of the Hebrews, there's no doubt in anybody's mind that a Gospel of the Hebrews existed, because we have extant fragments that exist today and exist now that come all the way back to from Papias and right around that time. So, there might be some change in the theology that was interpolated into the Gospel of the Hebrews. We don't know for sure, because no one has yet found a Hebrew Gospel of Matthew. So let me just look at this for a moment. All right. A number of people have tried to put together what they think is a Hebrew Gospel of Matthew. Now, it says there a Gospel of the Hebrews, but these other scholars have tried to put together a Hebrew Gospel of Matthew. And maybe the one that is strongest and most scholars think is maybe close to an original Hebrew Gospel of Matthew is a work put together by George Howard in 1995. And he took the writings in a book called The Touchstone by a Jewish author named Shem Tov. That's usually how I pronounce his name. Shem Tov is another way it's written out. But he took Shem Tov's Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, which in his book was quite polemical. I mean, it was, you know, it never put Jesus' name with Messiah next to it and other things. But the Jews were not being treated very well in Spain at the time. So, you know, some resentment is pretty understandable. But this was a 15th century text. And so he took Shem Tov's Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, removed some of the polemical statements, and took other material from that was in Hebrew from around that time and put together a Hebrew gospel in Matthew. Now, he took material that was from the Nazarenes, from the Hebrews, whoever that group exactly was, and the Ebionites. They're sometimes called the Gospel of the Nazarenes, the Gospel of the Hebrews, and the Gospel of Ebionites. It all, in the end, it all got thrown together from all of these different groups and called simply the Gospel of the Hebrews. But again, it starts with the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew. We have another person who's attempted to put together Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, a Van Rensburg in 2022. And although the English is very beautiful, I think he is does not have as much support as George Howard does. And George Howard's been had been attacked for putting this together too. Mm-hmm. Break in anytime you want. So I took George Howard or Shem Tov's Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, and then I began to I read a lot of material, and then it just something boils up, and I began to write a book or write something. And so one interesting thing is James Tabor, who probably most of you've heard about, a scholar of ancient Christianity. I believe he knows Greek, and he knows Hebrew. And his close look at George Howard's Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, he compared, and this was grueling because I tried to do this myself, quite grueling work. He compared all of the Q sayings in the Shem Tov text and found that many of them, 22 of them, were closer to the Gospel of Thomas than to the Greek Luke or Matthew. And I thought that was, I have to admit, we don't have the original Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, but if George Howard's is close to the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, and he took it from Shem Tov's medieval 15th century text, which may have some tie back to the original Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, then it's possible that some of these 22 verses are what Shem Tov had put in there and what George Howard had put down. I think that's one way of connecting the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of the Hebrews, which is also mostly Matthew's text. Let me get a little drink of water.
No problem. Yeah, very interesting. Thanks.
Now, another young man, I shouldn't call him a young man. I believe he's in his late 20s, or I'm not sure exactly, but an Aaron Miller. And I didn't find this until after my book was published. I don't know why I missed it. It might be because of the title, but it didn't come up. He created an Orthodox, Messianic Gospel of the Hebrews. And I noted that he put down the sources that he used. So his Q source was simply taking the verses from Matthew and Luke that have been linked to Q. And he had many other Orthodox sources, which he took from, but in particular, he also took from the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, which is considered Gnostic in origin, and the Gospel of Pseudo-Matthew, also with a Gnostic origin. These are apocryphal texts from the Protoevangelium of James and the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, and finally the Epistle of Barnabas. But when you read his text and compare it to mine, for example, he doesn't bring out verse 2 or 22 of Thomas, whichever one it is that I quoted. I can't remember how he exactly wrote that out, but he doesn't note, and I don't mean to be putting him down or or anything like that. He wrote a fine messianic gospel of the Hebrews, but he doesn't bring out that that is a really well-known Gnostic verse among other Gnostic verses. And he wanted to produce a gospel of the Hebrews, which was orthodox and canonical. And I think he did a decent job on that. So kudos to him for that, but different than my approach. Now here's a picture or of the handwriting of Shem Tov. So mm-hmm. Everybody can take a look at that. That comes from his Hebrew Gospel of Matthew. And I think that's kind of interesting to look at.
Very.
And then this is in George Howard's Hebrew translation of it, and his putting it into very readable Hebrew. Again, it's a 14th to 15th century handwritten from the 14th century to late 14th century to 15th century writing by Shem Tov of the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew. So I was looking at that, and then on the next page was his transliteration of the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew in English. Very grateful to have that. Again, here's another page from Shem Tov, and you can see the Hebrew that George Howard took from it. Again, Howard made some changes, so they would be slightly different, but nevertheless, you can see what he did, and it is the text that I use for my underlying Matthew. Now, here's a page from Van Rensburg's Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, not Gospel of the Hebrews, but Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, and it's from the Vatican EBR 100. This has got a very strange background. Van Rensburg's Hebrew Gospel of Matthew actually was in Hebrew when Rensburg and the people working with him found it, but they knew it had been translated from Catalonia, which, according to my wife, who speaks excellent Spanish, is not Spanish. I don't know what it is exactly, but it is a province in Spain. And right. And so according to Van Rensburg and some others working with him, they felt that this Hebrew Gospel of Matthew that they knew had come from Catalonia they considered that it was derived from a Hebrew text. So they believe somebody translated it into Hebrew, possibly mm-hmm. either a convert to Christianity to help out suffering Jews that were, forced to become Christians or had become Christians and wanted to become Christians. And so, but this was in Hebrew so that they could read the Gospel of Matthew in Hebrew. And then, it was translated back by Rensburg and some of his people, it was translated by somebody else. We don't know who that person was, but the scholarly consensus is it was a Jew that translated the Catalonian Gospel of Matthew back into a Hebrew Gospel of Matthew. And that was in the Vatican, and that's what they found. And Rensburg is going forward with primarily claiming he thinks this is maybe the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, the real Hebrew Gospel of Matthew. Now, there are Jewish religion and Hebrew scholars such as David Flusser, who was very famous for a long time, and a more modern Nehemiah Gordon, who strongly believe a Hebrew Gospel of Matthew existed. And they use the Shem Tov Hebrew Gospel of Matthew in discussing whether the Apostle Matthew actually produce it or not. David Flusser was, it made other Jewish scholars and some Christian scholars mad at him. They weren't happy with him saying good things about the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, which he did. Flusser came to believe that Jesus could read and speak Hebrew, read and speak Greek, or lesser Greek with David Flusser. Nehemiah Gordon felt that Jesus, and they're both Jews, could also speak Greek and Hebrew along with Aramaic, because their Jesus' father, a tecton or a carpenter and mason, did business. And so to do business in that society at that time, knowing those three languages was really helpful. So there's a Christian religious scholars and Hebrew scholars, Roy Blizzard and James Tabor, and they also believe that a Hebrew Gospel of Matthew existed. I'm going to take a little drink here. So we already went through this. Now there's controversy about this too. There's controversy about everything. But I believe that there were some Jews living along the southern west coast of India, near the Common Era, beginning of the Common Era, first century. And these were Jews of the first diaspora. I believe they were living in Kerala and a city called Cochin. And so that's where both Thomas and Bartholomew went to preach in 52 and Bartholomew in 55 Common Era. Now, this was quite common for Christians. They weren't called Christians yet, or they probably didn't call themselves Christians yet. But it was very common, just as we know what Paul did, for other apostles to go to where there was a Jewish synagogue, where there was a community of Jews living. And so I think that they went there, and by the time they got there, what was going on there? It was a place where trade was going on between the Roman Empire and India for spices and all sorts of different things. And so that's where people normally sell to, and I believe there are a variety of communities there. And even if there weren't Jews living there, they could have found somebody to help who had lived there long enough that they knew the language in that area of India, which was called Malayalam. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, and knew both Aramaic and Malayalam, and so they were able to translate for both Thomas and Bartholomew. Interestingly enough, the Acts of Thomas, which you probably heard about, grab a drink. You've heard about the Acts of Thomas, I'm pretty sure most people have.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful text, yeah.
What's really interesting about that is, as Miguel knows, there's a thing called the criteria of embarrassment. And when scholars come across something that seems really embarrassing in the New Testament, they came to the decision that it was so embarrassing, they had to put it in there because it was overwhelmingly true. And so when you look at the Acts of Thomas, think about this. I'm going to say something that's going to be almost shocking. In the history, Jesus says to Thomas, the apostle Thomas, he says, "I want you to go to India." And Thomas says, "I don't want to go to India." And he said, "You're going to India." Now, this is the resurrected Jesus, my understanding, of the body, palpable body that could not be differentiated than a human being. But Jesus said to Thomas, "You're going to India." And Thomas said, "I won't go to India." So Jesus went to a ship, a person that owned a ship that did trade with Cochin and Kerala. And he said to him, "I have a slave." Jesus Christ said, "I have a slave." And he's a tecton. He's a carpenter and a mason. And he, I believe you need one to build a palace for one of your kings back in India. And he said, "Yes, I do." And so Jesus said, "I'm selling you my slave." And so he sold Thomas as his slave to, I think his name was Abanes, that owned the ship that would sell Thomas to Kerala and Cochin in India. Now that is, to me, that's so embarrassing. And to actually say Jesus Christ sold him as a slave, that is so embarrassing. Yeah. But there must be some kernel of truth in it, wouldn't you think, Miguel?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, obviously we're in the criterion of embarrassment territory, but yeah, something must have been happening. It's hard.
So I do think Thomas did go to India. I feel very strongly that Bartholomew went to India, and I'll give other reasons for that. Thomas did then sell with this his new master. And we'll get around to that. Let me see. So I pretty much covered that in what I was just talking about. We know that the Roman shipping and trading to Cochin, India began at least 50 years before the turn of the century. So it was going strongly when Jesus asked Thomas to go there and preach. There's Van Rensburg's again, his gospel, Hebrew Gospel of Matthew portion. So here we have India, and you can see they spelled Cochin Kochi, but it's you can see also Kerala there. That's the southwest corner of India where Thomas and I believe Bartholomew and Pantanus went to speak to the Indians. By the time Pantanus went to speak to the Indians, I believe they had adopted somehow the name Nasranis for themselves too. Now, one thing that I think is very interesting is James Robinson had a community that was doing research on Q. Do you think most people know what Q is, Miguel?
Yeah. Especially looking at the chat, there were some arguments. Even though I think most of academia doesn't buy it, it's still a kind of a controversial theory or hypothesis. But yeah, most of the audience knows.
Yeah, this won't go away. And James Robinson and a large community made the decision that Q existed, or one of the very strongest reasons they believe Q existed is because they came to accept that Bartholomew really went there and that he came back and brought the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, not Bartholomew, I'm sorry, that Bartholomew really went there. But later in 190 Common Era, that Pantanus went there, and he did see a Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, which was becoming less and less popular, less and less copied, because most of Christianity was now being practiced outside of Israel and using Greek rather than Hebrew or Aramaic and so forth. So it might have been a little harder to find, and Pantanus saw this Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, and he brought it back to the catechetical school of Alexandria, really the first university of Christianity to exist. And he let everybody look at it. So Origen looked at it. Clement of Alexandria looked at it a lot. And very shockingly, Jerome looked at it repeatedly and said all sorts of things. Jerome.
Mm.
I get nervous and I cough a little more. So when I'm playing with the symphony orchestra, I'm sucking on a cough drop the whole time. But so it was James Robinson's group felt that Pantaenus brought back the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, and it contained many of the sayings and verses that are now recognized as Q, and so that the reality of Q existing earlier than the other Gospels and other texts was real. Now, it is shocking to understand that Papias, who sat at the feet of the Apostle John, said that Matthew first wrote his text in Hebrew for the believing Hebrews, and this had to be before 55 Common Era of the first century. So this is when Paul is writing, and we don't know the exact form it was in, but certainly if it resembled anything near to the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew that has been produced, it would have had much of what we consider Q. And so it may be where Q came from, or, you know, functioned as Q did. So I put, was this Logia of the Lord, the infamous Q? Well, I think it might have been the infamous Q, or at least it certainly had many of the sayings that would become or that would be called Q, which are the sayings in Matthew and Luke that Jesus says that are not found in Mark and John. That's a primary definition for it. Of course, Q comes from the word German quill and is a hypothetical source of the sayings of Yeshua HaMashiach. I like Yeshua HaMashiach. I like saying Yeshua. But kind of mixing it up right now a little bit. So anyway, I do think it may be the source of Q or what could have been considered to be Q. And of course, I want to remind everybody that this was a literate culture that we're talking about. The Israelite culture was literate. I believe Jesus was literate. Not everybody does. I've heard people say that the saying where Jesus says, you know, everybody has some place to lay down, but the Son of Man doesn't have a place to lay his head, and that means he was poor. Well, he wasn't.
He was being stoic, or, you know.
Well, he was walking around now with a group of Talmudin or disciples, students, and they were taking food from people after they preached. But what I think is that his family, growing up with, at least for a while, Joseph and Mary and his other brothers and sisters, they were at least, when Jesus was born, they were at least able to take two pigeons to the priest at the temple. Now, if they were really poor, you know, really poor, they might have only been able to take a little grain, a little touch of wine. Yes, they didn't take a lamb and a pigeon, but at least they took two pigeons. So, and I don't know of any place in our Christian literature, including in the apocryphal literature, where it states that they lived in great poverty as a family. I'm not aware of it. Are you aware of anything regarding
that? No, I think that's sort of a later marketing, if you would. I mean, number one, In that culture, for you to be heard, you had to have education. You had to know the Torah, the Tanakh, Greek, you know what I mean? They weren't going to listen. It was just the way society was structured. So, I mean, I think even Peter and everybody else probably had some education. And then, of course, if you look at all, like you said, his life, he wasn't poor. I mean, the Gospel of John says at the wedding, although, you know, the wedding at Cana, although it's disputed these days, you know, Mary had servants, slaves, who knows? Maybe Thomas was one of the servants there before they shipped him off. But yeah, they were educated. They had to be. The same with Muhammad. People obviously like, oh, Muhammad was not educated, didn't read. But when you look, it's probably the same sort of, you know, later on addition to make it more palatable to the common man. But Muhammad was probably educated too. Well, they do it with Buddha, Krishna, it's the same thing.
Yeah. I suppose you're supposed to be able to, I guess they believe some people have an extraordinary ability to hear something a few times, you know, and retain the entire New Testament. It's absurd. And now science has proven that it's just not possible, not even for a quarter of the Gospel of Matthew. So I think it strongly points, and this is my belief, I can't prove it, but I think it strongly points to Jesus having had a yeshiva education. And some people don't want him to have had a yeshiva education for whatever reason. But I believe he did. I believe he memorized the entire Old Testament. But he had many parchments to look at and to go back to. And not only that, they repeated it out loud over and over again, just like modern day Jews, and you see them shaking their heads. Part of that may be in remembering verses from the Old Testament that they want to speak or say in some religious setting. So I think Jesus, therefore, knew what it took to take his students and to teach them his version of or interpretation of Torah. And so he had Matthew write down. And what question? Nobody questions whether Matthew had an education or not. The publican, the tax collector, who had to be able to speak in Greek, Aramaic, and I believe he was also highly educated in Hebrew too. And so he would have been an excellent person to write down what Jesus was saying as he went along with him and the other apostles while he was doing his mission. And so that's another idea that I want to share. So we know that something that has been more opaque and is beginning to be clearer and clearer is what was going on in the second century of Christianity. And there was much more going on at that time than we were kind of led to believe in the past. But we simply didn't know what was going on in the second century. And however, with the internet, this incredible way of communicating, people are able to get the sources, and so the second century is coming alive. Let me go on here. Oh, that's ridiculously too small. Now, there was some verses that are considered Gnostic in the Gospel of the Hebrews are the church fathers say are from the Gospel of the Egyptians. This is not the same as the holy book of the great invisible spirit, which was called wrongly the Gospel of the Egyptians when they found all the Nag Hammadi library and writings. So today, they've tried to change it so that when they speak of this, the holy book of the great invisible spirit, if they're going to say something about it being Egyptian, or they call it the Egyptian gospel. And so scholars call the gospel of the Egyptians a separate text. And so I just want to clarify that. And the gospel of the Egyptians, many scholars believe it was very similar to the gospel of Thomas. Maybe the two texts were, one was expanded from the other. But there's a number of times when they quote from the gospel of the Egyptians, and you know immediately you've heard that in the from the gospel of Thomas. So it was written in Greek, and we know that. Let me look here for just a moment. There was a Council of Hippo in Common Era 397, the Council of Carthage, and they made a suggestion of which books should be in the canon. They didn't make a definitive decision as to which books were in the canon. They just made a suggestion of which books should be in the canon. That would come later when they finally make a decision to keep the Gospel of John as canonical and orthodox, and get rid of the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew and Gospel of the Hebrews, both of which were around at that time. So the Gospel of the Hebrews, which is the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, but taken by Ebionites and Nazarenes, which Epiphanus says is the more Gnostic sect, the Ebionites. The book, the Gospel of Hebrews, was confirmed by Jerome and Irenaeus, who is highly known for having written against all heresies. And Origen, Clement of Alexandria, and Eusebius, the first Christian historian, also talks about both of these gospels existing at that time. Now, Basilides, who was a early second century Gnostic and Christian, although I don't know if he thought of himself as a Gnostic, but nevertheless, he is considered a Gnostic. He said that in the Gospel according to the Hebrews, you could read this saying, "Marvel at things present, placing this down as the first degree of the knowledge of the beyond, and he who marveled shall reign, and he who reigned shall rest." So once again, there's that word rest, which scholars say is equivalent to saying reach gnosis and salvation, or at least you're on the way to gnosis and salvation. And supposedly Basilides was actually sat at the feet of Matthias, who was the apostle who was chosen to take over Judas' place. So that either makes him the 12th apostle or the 13th apostle. I'm not sure, but he took over Judas' position. And according to Basilides, this is one of his sayings. It's similar to other things we see, such as in the Gospel of Thomas 5, Jesus says, "Recognize what is in your sight, and that which is hidden from you will become plain to you, for there is nothing hidden which will not become manifest." Clement of Alexandria, who was in the catechetical school in Egypt, taught Origen, one of his prime students, that in the Gospel of Hebrews was, "The man with a sense of wonder shall be king. The man who has become king will be at rest." So these were different people that are well known in the history of Christianity state that these were all found in the Gospel according to the Hebrews. Now, we have these people saying these things, but we don't actually have a gospel of the Hebrews and sitting in our hands and able to turn to the page where that saying is made. But I don't think it's believed that these people were, you know, liars or made it up and so forth. Right. So that it's a little more of a, how some, what I consider some Gnosticism was within this text. And I tried to do what James Tabor had done and compare the Gospel of Thomas by Stephen Davies, the Gospel of Thomas, which was my own translation, the Gospel of Matthew 1930, the Gospel of Matthew from the NET translation, the NET translation, which is a very large number of scholars. It's like 55 scholars of Greek, Hebrew, and Coptic, and so forth, who have looked at these texts and tried to get the most accurate translation as possible. Now, they do derive from an evangelical background, so of course you should also look at some Catholic literature and other literature and compare too. But I felt that they probably did a pretty good job with the translation, and so I put these other translations down. So the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew we have for 1930, many who Shemta, but many who are first will be last, and many who are last will be first. And so I tried to do some of the work that James Tabor did. It was backbreaking, but I believe Tabor was correct. And I did it with the Beatitude for the Persecuted. These are in my text, this is in the book I wrote. And so you can take a look at these and see what you think. Now, there have been many people who questioned whether Q exists or not. There was a group that was working under James Robinson, who were trying to make a decision as to what Q was and did it really exist and so forth. And they, the final piece of the puzzle for them was finding that Pantaenus had brought back the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, and that so many people had looked at it and had quoted from it. And so they felt that this was strongly supported the concept of original Q, and then went forward to produce their own ancient Q. So we have, let me look at this for just a second. Yeah, there's over 25 biblical scholars working on NET. So under NET we have, do not be afraid of them, for nothing is hidden that will not be revealed, and nothing is secret that will not be made known. We have Shem Tov, Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, do not fear them, because there is nothing which will not be seen, nor hidden which will not be made known. Pretty close. And so this acceptance by them that Thomas really went there, that Bartholomew really went there, the Indian, that Bartholomew probably took a Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, and that's what Pantaenus brought back, was kind of the final thing that made them decide, let's go ahead and publish Q. Now, Q is somewhat mm-hmm. different than this, but it's because of the sayings of Jesus in the Gospel of the Hebrews and stated by the church fathers that was in that or in the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew, that they decided to go ahead with and actually make a Q. Move on to something else. Now there's a Coptic saying in Gospel of Thomas 46b. Whoever among you becomes little will know the kingdom and will surpass John. When you look at the Coptic word, which let's see, I think it's here. This is the Coptic word, a little blurry, sorry about that. A little one. But when you look it up, you see that it means that one of its primary meanings is to become humble. So you could have whoever among you becomes humble will know the kingdom and will surpass John. And so that's in the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew and is also in my text. So this is more of the sayings and my comparison of the Shem Tov text and Q. Q from the Q published by Robinson and his group trying to bring out an actual ancient Q as best they could. Now here's another little bit of a controversy. Originally in the New Testament, James called his followers the poor. And so they were called the Ebionim. However, I believe that this was that James was giving a literal functional description of his group, that they were that this period of time for the economy and in Jerusalem and so forth was like the Depression. It was a bad time. I don't know why exactly, but I believe when he said that to Paul, he was telling the truth. They were really poor. Some people want to name them the Ebionim. I think they were just describing their real state and asking him to keep them in mind. And if they could bring something back, they would appreciate it. And that's exactly what Paul did. Of course, he died for doing it, but that's another issue.
Yeah, so I think in the second century, we also have to mention the Ebionites hated Paul. They were the first ones to associate or connect Paul and Simon Magus, that they were the same person, and they did not like. So they were Gnostic, but they didn't like Paul.
Right. Yeah. We're going to get to that, I think.
Okay. So I jumped the gun.
Oh no! I please break in. Think you have great knowledge regarding all this material. So I actually think, though, that James was still calling themselves the way followers of Jesus, the Jewish Messiah. And also they were called by others and may have called themselves the Nazarenes. Mm-hmm. But the Nazarenes is a term that is all over the place, and we'll try to get to that. Some Epiphanius, I used to say his name was Epiphanius, but I looked it up and it's Epiphanius. That's difficult for me to actually say.
I always call him Epiphanius.
Yeah. So I think that the James group was not actually labeled the Ebionim except in a functional way. They really were poor and they needed help and they appreciated help. The later Ebionites took the name on, and I think it's very possible that it was derived from James' use of the word and their use of the word Ebionim, but I think they were separate movements. Epiphanius, it's funny to say that, described the Ebionites, who called themselves the Ebionites, and this was later in the second century, and third and fourth century, this is actually talking about them in the fourth century, were ascetic Jewish Christians, sometimes also called Nazarenes. And he considered the Nazarenes more Gnostic.
Hey, shining crazy diamonds. Please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten, and the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.